David Week. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Daryl. Thanks for asking me on.
My pleasure. So, David, I'm really sort of interested in, you've got a really kind of different background from most of the people I've spoken to. I'm interested in how you found yourself at Gathering.
Well, it was a bit of a coincidence, really. I picked up a tweet, I think, that had been retweeted by somebody from David Hood originally, and it looked kind of interesting, so I passed it on, and then somebody from the United States on Twitter said, hey, you should go to this thing. It looks really good. So a bit on impulse, I said, okay, I will. And I think what attracted me to it was very future-oriented, and also there was this strong thread of how technology can help us kind of build the future. And both of those really appealed to me.
Okay, so perhaps just give us a brief background about the work you do and how that sort of relates, because I think, you know, I probably think that's the thread of why it interested you.
Mm. Well, I basically work in international development, so that means working for clients like the World Bank, Fred Hollows Foundation, CARE, or AusAid. And right now I'm working on a Red Plus project in Kalimantan, a schools project in Laos, and some health projects for Fred Hollows. I'm an architect by training, so I look after the kind of either the project management side or the physical infrastructure side of these projects.
Yep.
And despite being in a very low-tech environment, or maybe precisely because of that, you end up very dependent, you know. You're dealing with a global team. People are all over the place. You're communicating via Skype and email all the time. And, of course, being the development industry, it's all about building people's futures. So this kind of future orientation and having global multicultural teams kind of working together to build a future, that's where the match is, I guess, between what I've been doing and what the appeal of the conference was.
Great. So did the conference match your expectations? What did you learn about yourself, about, you know, projects and ideas that you got from the conference?
Mm. Well, I didn't learn what I – actually, I didn't really have any expectations, because somehow the message of the conference beforehand was very open-ended and broad and non-specific. And I was a little bit worried going in that it might be a little too vague and kind of new agey. But that's not what I found at all. So the really interesting things that I found at this conference, was that there were a lot of interesting people there from a big variety of backgrounds, who are doing a lot of interesting things or had done interesting things in their lives. I got exposed to some really interesting new ideas, like those of Michel Bowens and John Hagel, which I had not come across before. And I thought the whole structure of the conference, which I understand came together just in the final week, was really dynamic, conversational, and interesting. I understand that before that final week or two, it was just going to be a standard stand and deliver speaker after speaker conference, which would have been pretty dull, I guess. But to see that even the management of the conference itself was, I thought, a benchmark and something that I think of nowadays whenever I think about how to organize a meeting.
Yeah, that's really great. So that's, I guess, rubbed off on your thinking about how we might organize and talk about, you know, and do meetings or conferences, mm-hmm. or whatever. That's great. I'm really interested when you said initially, because the idea was very open, that you were concerned about it being too vague. But because my experience is very same, I've done a lot of work with open space and a lot of work in facilitating meetings in where it's very self-organizing, and that's a people's fear when they first come in, that it's very broad, that, you know, But once they push through that and understand that it works, they're like blown away that it, you know, even though there's no structure, so to speak, that things actually work out really well.
I mean, what's interesting is that, in fact, at the introduction, I think, of the World Cafe, they made a critique of the World Cafe, and they said it can be too unstructured. So they deliberately mixed a bit of structure in with the World Cafe to drive it in a certain way. So I thought that was interesting. And things like the, I forget what they're called, the 5-minute talks or the...
Mm-hmm. The Ignite sessions or something?
Though. Yeah, the Flash talks or Speed talks or something like that.
Yeah, Lightning talks, I think.
Lightning talks, there we go. Yeah. So you know, and those are highly structured. You have to be very highly disciplined to give a talk in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So I thought that kind of highly structured mixed with the unstructured, that was a good mix. I've been to events where the whole day is... you know, open space, and it's terrible. Or my experience has been terrible, I should say.
Yeah. Sure.
So they got somehow the cocktail right.
A nice one. So you were talking about some of the interesting people you met and the ideas. Can you talk to us about some of those that you found interesting?
Look, I think I've become... very postmodern in the sense of suspicion of meta-narratives. Every time I hear some kind of big story about the way history is going, you know, I go, yeah. Like we've heard those before. But I thought especially Michelle Bowens told a very, very compelling story based on what he called, you know, the guy with the beard being Marx, of perhaps where the economy is going. Mm-hmm. And even though I don't trust these stories as predictions, because I know history is wildly unpredictable, I did think that he told a very compelling story about how one might approach the future by looking at things like online communities and how to structure them and how they have to be structured and how they work and how to put that together with the fact that people have to earn a living. So even though they might give for free into an online community, at some point people need employment. So these online communities generating ideas and value and so forth somehow have to have a commercial back end or something to pay for themselves and also to create an economy which in which people can eat as well.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think the biggest thing that I came out of from there was, I mean, it was very invigorating to hear a lot of ideas. It was very invigorating to see that there were people out there that were really committed, enthusiastic, and visionary about the future. But at the same time, it still seemed like mainly at the idea of talk. There were very few examples, and none to me compelling, of anybody in the group actually doing something which was taking off. So that brought to me, I mean, that the central question really isn't energy or ideas or stuff, but actually building a new kind of business model where those things can actually make you a living or make a group of people a living and not just, you know, an impoverished living, but a good living. Mm-hmm. So I know that as soon as you've got a good living going, then you're going to attract other people that you know, they've got kids, they've got families, they've got mortgages, and they can't live off the smell of an oily rag. They need something that works at all those other levels. So I think that's the main challenge for a lot of the ideas there, is to take it to that next step of past the early adopter and into that early majority.
Yeah, so you're saying a lot of the people, a lot of the ideas were very ideas. They haven't got to the implementation stage yet, or that they're very sort of early ideas, you think?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I know David's got some ideas around this, but yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've talked about a couple of people that I've spoken to is how do you harness this energy that obviously is a great energy as part of the conference, but how do we harness that and move it forward? So yeah, I'm fairly sure David's got some plans to move it forward, and you know, one of them is doing things like this to keep the conversation going, keeping people reflecting on the event and what they might do, and you know, based on what they learnt, and to keep the keep the relationships building and those sort of things as well. So just on that, did you sort of make any connections at Gathering that you might see something coming from?
Yeah, look, I've connected and in some cases reconnected with a few people, and who I'm now in touch with. I mean, we also have Skype sessions. I'm having a Skype session next week with Christine Egger, for instance, from the United States. So there is an ongoing conversation, but again, my experience with conversations about ideas is unless they start engaging with the road,
yep,
they'll peter out. So I'm looking for that path through the conversations into making something happen, which produces a return, which attracts people, which makes more happen, and then you get that kind of positive cycle going.
Yeah. So what is it that we can do to move from that incubation stage, idea stage, to sort of laying some rubber on the road? What do you think? Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing I was sharing with a friend of mine the other day is nowadays I get involved with things for, like, my criteria is that it's worthwhile doing. The people are, you know, good to work with. We have a good time. There are no office psychopaths or anything around. And but the third is that there's kind of proper remuneration, because it's easy to do the first two. It's just you run out of steam after a while. And so I think that the first two are there. So it's really, I think, being quite focused now on, let's not talk about, you know, community anymore. I'd say let's not generate more ideas. There's heaps out there already. Yep. And a lot of them seem to have potential. Now it's a question of, all right, how do we generate an income stream from this so that we can start to, you know, create that cycle where the income stream then supports people in their lives and therefore they have more time to give, and round it goes. Personally, I've already become involved with an NGO here called Co-Design, and which is started by Lucinda Hartley, who's a Melbourneian, and part of my main contribution is to figure out that income stream for them, and then see if we can make that happen. Because anyway, bottom line though is I think that it's time to really focus on that. And in a kind of very, I don't want to say ruthless, but focused way, you know. Because until that happens, it's like you've only got two ingredients to the magic and not the third.
Sure. I guess that's what a lot of businesses that even, you know, commercial or not commercial businesses go through in their growth phase is, you know, from an idea through to, you know, marketing and building that and building their revenues and doing that. So it's a challenge not just for, you know, I think not for this, not just for this group of people, but for all businesses, really.
Mm. Yeah, I thought one of the interesting things about the film, The Social Network, whether it was fiction or fact is another question, but just this idea that that the founders were kept on putting off kind of commercializing it because it was cool, you know, and they knew that as soon as they commercialized it, they had there was the chance that it would cease to be cool. And once it was no longer cool, they thought they were dead, that their product was dead. Mm. So, but at the same time, it's quite clear that they were very canny about getting money and moneyed people involved. So, yeah. So I think that's an interesting film to watch from this point of view. Because yeah. It did very much start off with nothing but, you know, kind of sweat equity and ideas.
I like that term, sweat equity. I like that one. I mean, I've been sort of thinking about that whole social entrepreneurship thing lately, and it seems to me that's one of the real challenges is getting that focus on building revenue and the different mix that, you know, social entrepreneurship provides in terms of how to structure, whether it's a for-profit company or whether it's a charity or whatever. Mm. But it's people are turning towards the different methods to try and change things. And entrepreneurship's obviously an increasing method that people are using for change. Mm-hmm. Which I find kind of fascinating myself, because there's a lot of I think a lot that businesses can learn from the social side of businesses and vice versa. I think a lot that not for profits can learn from commercial businesses as well.
Yeah. No, I think there's some kind of hybrid model that needs to emerge. But it's just not, and not just one model, obviously. There's going to be many models.
Yeah.
So one of my kind of tasks that I set myself is to keep an eye out for what some of these hybrid models might be. So there's a lot of ideas out there, and I'm very interested in both with co-design and with my own consultancy, to just start implementing them, to try them out, because that's I think the only way we'll know if they work.
Yeah. Tell us how you're thinking you might do that with your own consultancy. You might sort of need to give me a little bit of a background on how you're sort of doing your consultancy and how some of these ideas might apply.
Mm. Well, right now it's just a private firm, and we go on a project basis, so there's a couple of directors that are full-time, and then we've got a group of other people that we pull in depending on the size and nature of the project. But, you know, it's just a PTY limited company operating the way a lot of consulting firms operate, which is as I just described it. But recently I've been building up this concept of a larger not-for-profit consulting firm, which will pull some of these smaller for-profit, or at least to say they're for-profit is not quite accurate, because I think the main driver of these small consulting firms is freedom, not profit. Pull them together in order to create a larger entity, mainly with the idea of not just working together, because that people do anyway, but to start to work together on positive products that are actually needed in the world, but nobody ever commissions. So one of the limitations of working as a consultant is usually you get a jobs from either the government or corporations, and what you end up doing is limited by the vision and agendas of government and corporations.
Yeah.
But as a professional, you're also seeing the bigger picture, and you're seeing all kinds of things that aren't being done because they don't happen to be on the agenda of a government or a corporation. So the idea would be to pull people together and get enough critical mass that we could start then using some of our time to address some of these unasked for social products. There's some ideas around the shaping of the city. There's some ideas around the way international development is done. There's some ideas about the way that people conceptualize their home start building those into products that are marketable and can pay for themselves, and then therefore expand the realm of consulting away from just the worldview of the big clients, which yep. tends to be fairly conservative, and out into kind of new domains, which could generate a lot of social value.
Yeah.
So, and how we structure that so it's equitable and people don't engage in office politics and this kind of stuff, that's all up for grabs. but it's in the design stage right now. I hope to have the first meeting on that before the end of the year. I shouldn't say hope. I should say plan. I've planned to have the first meeting on that before the end of the year.
Being positive.
Yeah, being definite.
Yeah. Well, to me, that really defines social entrepreneurship to me is, you know, you're seeing as a, you know, professional, as you stated, you're seeing things that aren't being done, and you're, you know, social things that aren't being done, and you're putting your effort and putting potentially some capital and some structure behind addressing those social needs. To me, that is, you know, a classic definition, if you like, of social entrepreneurship, where people are going out and they're seeing things that just government or industry aren't tackling, or even some of the not-for-profits, because of the, you know, systemic nature of things, they're not tackling them. And so you're seeing opportunities there to tackle those problems in a innovative way. And
right.
Yeah, to me, that is, you know, the whole... and a lot of people, I think, are moving in this direction, which is really interesting.
Mm. Yeah, no, it is interesting. What about yourself? I'm not supposed to be interviewing you, but I may as well ask.
Well,
what's your own hot button in terms of things that need to be done out there?
Well, this project for me to do podcasting for Gathering 11 is, in a little way, part of that. I'm really fascinated by social enterprise and people working and entrepreneurship, so, and people working in this space. So this, for me, was a bit of a pilot project to perhaps do something bigger in regards to running a small media company focused on telling stories of people doing this stuff, because one of my passions is hearing people and enabling people to tell their stories. So yeah, I'm looking at how to create my own social enterprise around this idea of being a small media company doing podcasts and perhaps doing some live broadcasting and things. So yeah, this is yeah, watch that space.
Okay, so, I will watch that space.
So, yeah, a bit like you, it's very early thinking at this stage.
Mm. But no, I can imagine there's a market for that out there, because I think there's you know, a lot of people that aren't happy in their work.
Mm.
A lot of highly skilled people working long hours and in not very inspiring jobs.
Yeah.
So if they could find a way to move out, and what's keeping them there is money, not meaning.
Sure.
And they don't want to move out to meaning, but have no money.
Yeah.
Mostly because most of them, I think, can't afford it. So the question is, how do you move into meaning and still earn a living? It doesn't have to be the same living that you had before, but you want it to be substantially, you know,
yeah, you've got to keep the walls from the door.
Absolutely.
So to speak. Yeah, it's a really, I think, you know, structurally, that's what, you know, people, perhaps that's the reason people are heading down this sort of path more and more. You know, they're particularly Gen Ys, they're not willing to sort of invest themselves in that corporate job or, you know, so they're taking a different path. And I think increasingly people a little bit more mature, like myself, are probably in the same boat, you know, looking at something with a little bit more meaning and a little bit more positivity as well, which is... So what other particular concepts were alive for you and got you thinking from Gathering?
Look, the other thing that was kind of interesting was the kind of... vertical age slice that I felt was there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a kind of Gen X, Gen Y, millennial kind of thing. I mean, there were people there from, I think the oldest guy I met there would have been Max, I think, who's from the Fabian Society. And I think that there's a really interesting connection that could be made between what I'd think of as old guard idealists and kind of New Guard idealists. Like, if you look at the Fabian Society, they've got enormous assets, you know. They've got a huge membership list, and that membership includes, you know, members of parliament and former prime ministers and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I'm sure they've got financial assets and stuff, but they're not really, the way they're structured now, really kind of attracted to anybody who's, like, in this new space. At the same time, there's all these people in the new space who, I'd say, have ideals that are fairly congruent, though different, with those older Fabian ideals, which are about, you know, equity, social equity and equality and justice and so forth. But they don't have any assets. And I thought, you know, if there was some way of connect the old social assets with the new social entrepreneurs, that'd be nice. I mean, I think the biggest risk is that if you talk to Fabians, for instance, they're very invested in the Fabian Society, the name, which doesn't mean anything to people, and the history, you know. But in order to actually pass those assets on to future activists and entrepreneurs, they've got to kind of somehow let go of all that. Mm. But so that's one kind of interesting connection that I think that came out of primarily from talking to Max from the Fabian Society, that kind of, and just also hearing from the people that were there that were social entrepreneurs and knowing a few of them and knowing how hard it is to get capital. Mm-hmm. So one of the big questions is how can we maybe mobilize these old forms of social capital, these older societies which have assets and buildings and stuff like that, but have kind of an aging membership, and connect them with the new without having them just trying to convert everybody to Fabianism, which I think doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that raises a really sort of interesting question, because the churches that you know, have got a massive capital in Melbourne. I think between the two or three denominations, they own 80% of Melbourne.
Mm.
Yeah, how do you know? And with less and less people going to church, what happens to their assets and things when, you know, there's fewer and fewer people?
You're right.
It's like that perennial business problem of, you know, the family business problem of you're handing the family business down. What do? Just close the door at the end, or, you know, right, hand it to your son, or so it's about having an exit strategy for them in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, though that takes quite a maturity of viewpoint, which, to be frank, I think that probably if you talk to 10% of the people, either in the churches or the older societies, you'd find that. It's just the other 90% that might stop that happening.
Mm.
You know, they reckon that these churches were set up for one purpose, and even if that particular purpose is kind of winding down, or declining, you know, there's a bigger agenda, which is helping people, which they could share those premises with, or even give them over, you know?
Yeah.
But whether, you know, they'd want to give a church over to Hub Melbourne, I think that's quite a stretch for... I think it's perfectly logical, you know, in terms of the social aims of the churches, for them to do that. But I think institutionally it'd be very hard.
Yeah.
But things can't happen unless somebody broaches the conversation.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, just bringing it up, it's an interesting idea to sort of have a dialogue around. And I think it's equally applicable to, you know, a number of things where, you know, with an aging society and an aging population in most Western countries, you know, there's going to be increasingly conversations about this thing, for not just for around entrepreneurship or whatever, but other systems as well. How do we continually engage and, you know, hand over, if you like, things from the older generation to bring in the newer ones? And, you know, that applies to a whole bunch of stuff, I think.
Yeah. Do you think it's as true of corporations, for instance? I mean, I think corporations seem to be pretty conscious of of this kind of whole thing of generational change and making sure they're getting influxes of younger people that are going to stick around and giving them incentives to stick around. Government, I'm not so sure of. I see lots of government departments where the younger recruits, they go in there, they stick around for 2 years, and they go, I don't want to be here. And then they go do something else. So you get a kind of, you know, older cadre that's in there for the long term, but really nobody's getting the level of expertise that you really need in order to run a government in the long term, or a government department, I should say.
Yeah, again, though, as you're saying, things will change, and I think, you know, the nature of government might change. We're seeing some of the changes happening in America, and the amount of input that the public are having in government, I think, is changing as well. So who knows? The changing face of government might incentivize different people to get involved.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I think it's an interesting...
Can I just... Yesterday, or no, actually it was last week, about the left, I think it's the Left-Right Foundation, is it? It's based in Canberra, and it's just about getting ideas, developing policy ideas without, completely free of party politics. And it's largely youth-oriented. So it's basically saying get involved with politics without getting involved with political parties.
Yep.
By contributing to the development of good policies, which then get pushed again without an attachment, which most think tanks do. So it's basically a kind of non-party, youth-oriented think tank. And that seemed like a really good, clever thing to set up in this kind of space.
Yeah, as you said, it's a different model, and it might attract people that otherwise might be put off by that sort of factional, sort of based thing. And, you know, perhaps with the church, something similar, a non-denominational spiritual approach, you know, might work as opposed to that religion versus this religion approach.
Yeah.
Because as you said, underneath, their aims are very similar in terms of helping people and things. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to grind away at that tribalism.
Yeah, sure. So how has attending the conference changed your perspective, David?
Look, I think it made me, because when I was originally having these kind of set up a new not-for-profit ideas, because I did set one up with a friend of mine when I was about 23, I think we set it up, and that ran for about 7 years up in Papua New Guinea. But then I just set up this consultancy thereafter. But when I turned my mind to setting something like that up again, I thought this is just me going through some kind of personal cycle or something. And it was fascinating to see how many people out there are kind of thinking in this space. So that was a revelation. And that made it much more real for me. So instead of thinking, you know, I can probably get this done if I think hard enough about it and try a few things out. Now I'm more of the mind, look, I'm going to get it done because this is what's happening now. You know, this is the wave and this stuff's going to happen. And therefore, I'm not kind of doing some odd thing by myself, but I'm part of a social movement which, just because of the numbers of peoples involved, will create this new space in the economy. So it's given me that kind of broader perspective and I guess an increased level of confidence that this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And therefore it's possible to make it happen because it's going to happen.
So you think there's a bit of a groundswell, so to speak, or a movement? You think there is a movement towards more social business or more social entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think this is even documented somewhere in one of these kind of books about kind of intergenerational change. I mean, basically what I'm getting is people I mean, it's just amazing, actually. I think, like, when I went to university, which was in the 70s, there was this enormous groundswell of, you know, people wanted social change more than they wanted a job. And that kind of, I think, in the 80s and 90s, that down died down. That swung the other way, and everybody seemed to wanted a job more than anything else.
Yeah.
And a car and a house and all of these other things. And now it seems to have swung back this way. And I think just people aren't convinced that a job and a house and a car are worth having, that you're going to basically spend your life, literally, you're going to take your life and turn it in order to get these things. Nobody's convinced of that anymore. Mm. Well, of course, some people are convinced of it, and possibly a vast majority are convinced of it. I don't know. But there seems to be, you know, maybe it's gone from 3% to 20% are now convinced that it's not such a good offer, and we got to do something different. But that's all it takes, just at the margins. Once you get 1,000 people instead of 100 people, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having a coughing fit. About that, folks. So where next? Where's the experience going to lead you? You mentioned, you know, you're going to do your project. You're hoping to kick that off this year?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Yeah. What else? Look, I'm at a stage. I've got this very satisfying and consulting work that I do on these aid projects. That works for me. I want to kick off this enterprise. There's all the usual family and friends stuff. I guess the other thing is that I want to become, you know, gain more leverage in these conversations. So I've started blogging, started tweeting, thinking about book projects and things like that. So I've been out of the kind of mass communication space, or even the social communication space, really. But I think it's just drawing me in. So I think a kind of central part of the way I see myself going is to try and build a presence in these larger conversations, because I think I've got something to say. I don't know that I've got something to say. I'll test that by saying it. But that's something that I want to try out.
Yeah. Fantastic. David Week, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot.